forgive me this evening if I don't sound too coherent. I'm still in Los Angeles with one foot and Hawaii and it with another. But I do have jotted down one note. I want to thank, first of all, Jerry, this is his swan song in a sense, for the most marvelous series that I think the seminar has experienced to date. Don't you hear it? I don't think that any of us are the same.
My pleasure.
Also, I'm happy to see that we finally have a convert of the boss. I knew we'd get you. I've had the most amusing hour. I spent it having dinner with Dr. Mitchell. And I can say only what the kids say. I really feel he's one of the most beautiful people I have ever met. Dr. Mitchell.
I'm speechless anyway. I'm speechless anyway before such a able and distinguished group of people. To speak under any circumstances would be difficult, but when Todd and his wife have given you each the volume in which I've put everything I know, I know some wonderful Uncle Remus stories. Just to get started, may I tell you an Uncle Remus story? Not exactly an Uncle Remus story. Those stories which no one should be ashamed of, they were the first protest literature of the Negro. And while they brush them aside now, they'll come back to see the shrewdness of old Uncle Remus. The rabbit was, as George Chandler Harris knew, the Negro. But George Chandler Harris failed to realize that the fox was really George Chandler Harris's father, the plantation owner, and that the wolf was the Simon Legree, the foreman, and Brabah was the white man's nigger, as they would say, always goes along. If you read them in that story, the one I'd like to tell you is the oldest humorous story, I think, in the world, 7,000 years old, and has a double meaning and a deeper meaning. It was found on the pyramids, on clay tablets, 7,000 years ago, when the pharaoh was having a crane for supper, and the slave that cooked it was embarrassed to find that her son had cut off one leg. And slaves have a great gift for making the best of a difficult situation. And I think a great deal of the genius of many Negroes today comes out of the fact that they've had generations of tutoring in making the best of a difficult situation. Well, that story was carried down through Africa and on a slave ship across. And one of these slaves used to tell me 65 years ago, but the goose that ain't had but one leg. If you all can't understand me, just guess her. She said the captain was going to have company for dinner. The captain's a plantation owner and was the pharaoh, translated. The captain was going to have company for dinner, and Miranda, that's the captain's cook, she's going to have a goose for supper. And Tom, that's Miranda's son, he come in from cutting wood and he says, Miranda, give me a piece of that eye goose. Miranda says, well, from here, boy, how am I going to give you in that goose? And the captain got company for dinner. But law, honey child, Miranda hadn't no more than turned her back. For Tom took up a carving knife and cut off one leg, smick, smack, smooth. Well, there wasn't nothing Miranda could do except to send in the goose with a missing leg on the side. When they come to the table, the captain says, with his hands behind his back, Lord bless us and bind us and tie our hands behind us and put us where the devil can't find us. Then Lord bless us and bind us as best you is able and I hope us to eat all on this end of the table. Amen. Then he says to the parson, Parson, which potion of the fowl would you prefer? The parson says, I bleeds, I'll take a leg, I thank you. He says, and deacon, which portion of the fowl would you prefer? I bleeds, I also would take a leg, I thank you. Miranda, oh Miranda, come here. Miranda, why this goose a leg? Kevin, that goose ain't had but one leg. Miranda, I say to you, why this goose a leg? Oh God, Captain, that goose ain't had but one leg. Miranda says to Captain, I'll have to see you about this out of dinner. So out of dinner, when the company was gone, Miranda and the Captain, they goes down to the creek where the gooses was. Bless your soul, honey, there they all was standing asleep. Natural as life on one leg. And Miranda, she says, damn now, Captain, what I told you, that goose ain't had but one leg. But the Captain, he clapped his hands and said, shoo, shoo. And the gooses, they put out their other leg. And the Captain said, down now, Miranda, what I told you? Miranda said, Lord, Captain, if you had to clap your hands and say, shoo, shoo, to that goose on the table that he'd have put out and killed me. Negroes have been so patient, so long, that day has come, and we better wake up to that fact, else revolt is going to turn into something like revolution. And while that couldn't succeed in any military sense, not moral sense, it could be terribly, terribly devastating to whites as well as Negroes. I think we need to give some serious thought to that. And you can see from this book, I've been betrayed by your being given, that I feel education ought to turn itself to problem solving, problems of that kind, before it's too late. And then when it's too late, people justify all kinds of means that would not have been necessary and justifiable if we'd had more foresight. Then let me presume that one or two of you haven't seen the book or saw it very skimpily, and run over it, and then perhaps there'd be some discussion and difference of opinion. But the man said he's going to run the meeting democratically if he had to run it himself. Well, it will not be that kind of meeting. I became aware a good many years ago that there was opportunity for a new form of education. In 1949, I went to the president of an airline and I asked what he would charge to keep an airplane going constantly around the world, letting students study for 1 year. He said then $50,000 for around the world for 50 people, $1,000 a person. Since that time, we have a firm price of $691 a person around the world in a zigzag course that would add to about 35,000. And I'm told that we can get that down considerably to something over $400 a person if we have a full plane going around. Well, many, many people were thinking along those lines. Unknown to one another, no communication, but the time was right. So that Oliver Caldwell says, and I think he knows, that there are at least 1,000 plans for world colleges that have sprung up recently. Now, from my point of view, it's a pity for new types of schools to spring up this way, much wiser for ones well established to set up experimental branches. If any of you know the president of Hofstra, you might suggest to him that he put his wing over Four Little Friends World Institute and make it an experimental branch of great Hofstra, just as New York University, I think, once put its wing, didn't it, over Hofstra. Because that accreditation that NYU supplied to Hofstra, and that Hofstra might supply to us, that's really invaluable, you know. Otherwise, you're in a vicious circle. You can't get funds because you don't have accreditation. You can't get accreditation because you don't have funds. So that out of these 1,000 or so plans, most of them will be stillborn. I got telephone calls from Lake Geneva. There's a man here, a dentist, who has a plan for a World College, but he doesn't have the capital. And the businessmen of Geneva will give you all several hundred acres of land, beautifully situated over the lake and so on. You come here. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, there's a Dr. Howard John Zitko. Has the whole thing, he's been working at it since 1946. He has 600 acres of land. He isn't getting anywhere. I doubt if within his lifetime he will, short of some miracle. So I went to Paris and found many, about 100 plans all drawn up and submitted to UNESCO. And Dr. Welling was kind enough to get them all out so that I could see them. Michael Zweig has written a book on the idea of a world university. Harold Taylor is greatly interested in it. Some of you doubtless know of many such ventures. They come out of a change in our scientific climate. Transportation, communication have become either instantaneous or, as in your case, from Hawaii to California to here in just a few hours and so on. Well, of course that's going to change things. And so, as John Dewey said, a philosophy consistently applied reveals itself in every detail. So these concepts of a world university tend to reveal themselves in similar manner in many of these plans. Let me speak in a general way, but try to illustrate, if you don't mind, from experience of Friends World Institute. I'd say that there are three chief characteristics of FWE, as we call it. The first is obvious, that the world is our campus. Now, I come by that honestly, because when my father was made president of the University of South Carolina many years ago, the campus of a few acres was surrounded by brick walls 6-8 feet high. The first thing he did was to tear down that wall that had been there 100 or so years and declared that the state of South Carolina was the campus of the university and the natural and logical one. Well, this is 50 years later. It's natural simply to expand that idea and say that the world is our campus. Perhaps from the volume or not, you understand that the plan is a simple one, that we have a center in North America, another in Latin America, one in West Europe, one in East Europe, one in Africa, one in India, and one in Japan. That we will in time accept 100 students each 6 months. We don't have that many applicants now. We've had about 600 faculty applicants and about 200 student applicants. So we are thinking right seriously of charging the faculty $2,625 and subsidizing the students just so that balance up, you know. They'd move from North America to Mexico or someplace in Latin America, wherever. Right now it's Morelia in Mexico. There would ideally be a plane full of people going. They would get off at Morelia and load the plane with students there and carry them to Stockholm, and then unload and load and carry them on to the Soviet Union, load and unload. So the plane would always be filled, and in that way there'd be a very great economy. In the plan, perhaps you gathered that it is intended to accept 100 students at each of these 7 centers around the world. Now, there are 7 centers because the last term, everyone is returned to his own home. If he starts in Africa, he ends automatically the last 6 months in Africa. Thereby, you get away from the difficulty that you bring them all to the United States and they like television and refrigerators and automobiles and so on, and they don't want to go back, and they've lost touch a good deal too. But in this way, they would be traveling with 100 Africans and so on. So that when the pipeline is full, there would be 5,600 students approximately divided between 7 campuses. And each campus would have 200 students from that particular region and 600 students from each of 6 other regions. 200 from that region because it'd be an incoming group and an outgoing group. Out at the Livingston property, we have architectural plans for the students and faculty in little clusters, 50 students around a meeting and discussion place, somewhat as our meeting here, but there'd be enough for 50 and books all around the wall, place for their eating. There'd be only about a fourth enough space for all of the students at any one time, because the others would be out studying, traveling. And we're going to have some of you engineers to make us a computer. It's already impossible for any one mind to remember where our students are. You know? And when you get so many of them out, and microbuses and planes and everything of that sort, we already have a good many microbuses over the world. You have to keep all of them insured and proper driving, everything of the sort. Some people are worried about too many of them coming to roost at the same time and there isn't enough room for them. It reminds one of the truck driver driving an enormous van in New York, holding up traffic for 2 or 3 miles, and the officer came up and said, "Why do you keep stopping this thing and beating with a club on the side of the van?" He said, "Get out of the way, officer. My axles won't hold but 2.5 tons, and I've got 5 tons of canaries in this van. I have to keep half of them flying at all times." Well, if there are any questions about that, we can take them up. But I think you feel 35,000 miles around the world in a zigzag course, and about 5,000 to 8,000 miles around each center by public transportation or bus, depending on the country and the circumstances, so that they scour all over the country. Now let's come to the program. It's based on the pragmatic method. I have great respect for Aristotle, whose mind was so logical that he organized not only all knowledge that he knew, but even the logical method. And as a young man, I studied Aristotelian logic. And then the pragmatic logic came in. But Aristotle had stood unquestioned for all those centuries. And our schools are really based very largely on the Aristotelian method. And that's why I mention about slums and so on. See, if you teach knowledge as an end in itself, then you've not acquired the habit of using knowledge as a means toward an end. I used to teach at Columbia University, though God has long forgiven me for that sin. But see, at Columbia we turned out countless economists, and have been for a long, long time there. And yet, just at the side door was Harvard. And all this knowledge helped the individual to succeed. His education was worth, $140,000 in his lifetime for a BA, a BS degree. But society kept on with these problems of race prejudice and poverty, overpopulation, crime, juvenile delinquency, war, hate, and so on. Now, we attempt the problem method. We take one of those problems as the object of study. I don't want a caricature to, formal education or make fun of it. For all of you in this room, it's worked very, very well indeed. But a great many people did not work for, and they've dropped out. They say that in Cleveland there was a superintendent who liked to look at his watch and say it's now 10:25 and 3,620 children in 10 seconds will begin saying together, Abu bin Adam, may his tribe increase, awoke one night from a deep dream of peace. He had this whole thing scheduled all over the city. Well, that's something of an exaggeration. Now let me illustrate, if you please, how I think it does make a very great difference. When I was at Columbia, I taught, among other things, a program in race relations. And I remember that a boy made an A, and he was very pleased about it, and I was glad for him to do so well. I don't care much about grades, never did. I always said at the first of each course that I didn't believe in fear or guilt, and that I didn't want anybody to study for extraneous rewards, that everybody in that class would get at least a C. And then if they wanted a higher grade, they could work. But I didn't want anybody anxious and worried. I wanted to study for the pleasure. Well, that worked all right, except that I had every football player at Columbia. You all are too young to remember Danny Taylor and Schultz, and maybe you remember Sidney Luckman. Well, he was put in the Hall of Fame the other year ago, and he wrote me a letter. Oh, thank you, Morris, for making it possible.
Very happy to take your course.
It didn't amount to anything. He had come in dutifully for conference. I said, Sidney, doing my duty. No, Sidney, you have a marvelous body, but it's neither as strong as that of an elephant, nor as agile as that of a tiger. Why are you putting your whole life on your physique? You have a fine mind, a fine personality. You could succeed in professions and so on. That's right, Doc. This is last season I'm going to play. It was always the last one. Then the end of the term came, and I had to make out a report. Well, he belonged in the fourth or fifth grade, and now this was a graduate course. Well, as a Quaker, I'm supposed to have a little conscience, you know. I didn't know it, but I solved it. I put, Sidney didn't fail, but I did. Well, nobody can. And I failed at that. Well, I think of this boy who made an A. He lived at 25 Claremont Avenue, you know this. One day I wanted to go to see him and happened to have a Negro with me. And when we got there, they wouldn't let us in. It was a segregated house. And he was living in it. Well, that did something to me, friends. When a person could make an A on human relations and was willing to live in a segregated house. Well, now let's see how. Please don't misunderstand that. I don't mean to exaggerate. I know a lot of the people that take human relations courses come out and have their fine attitudes and all, but that's an actual case. Now a group comes in here. Our students are from the middle and upper class. They've never, for the most part, been the victims of race prejudice. You can't really feel a problem until you've experienced it. You can't take a great interest in solving it. Poverty is terribly hard, much harder than you'd think, to get the students of Friends Royal Institute to take an interest in what can be done to obviate poverty. Now, there are ways. How many people are there in Denmark? 6 9/10 million or something. No natural resources except the soil and a good market in England and no poverty to speak of, no unemployment to speak of. Well, if they can cannot accomplish that with nearly no resources. Why in the world do we have poverty in Texas with all the power that they have in minerals and everything of the kind? But to get the students to really care about that is not easy, I can tell you. Now, any of these other problems, they are often wound up emotionally because of these problems. Vietnam, the draft, you know, slums, and tend to dislike what they like to call the establishment, but they aren't immediately drawn into study. So, for instance, we'll take them into Harlem and dump them out on the street with 25 cents in the pocket. And the game is to see how long you can stay in Harlem on 25 cents. You can't steal. You can beg, you can borrow, you can pawn anything you have. And they learn, for instance, to go through telephone booths to see if people have left dimes and stuff. It gets right embarrassing when you need to go to the toilet and they're all locked, and you learn to wait till somebody comes out, and then you run and grab the door, you know, before it swings shut on you. I remember one lovely Quaker went in with a group, and I said, "How did things go?" He said, "Oh, beautiful." I said, "What do you mean, beautiful?" He said, "Well, as this beautiful new car stopped, and these students, nicely dressed, got out, little Dave Eppers was confronted by an enormous Negro who just didn't like Dave Eppers, so well dressed, coming out of this car in Harlem. What was he doing there?" And so he began abusing Dave. She said, Dave looked up at him and smiled and said, "You know, my friend, there's that of God in both of us, and we were meant to be friends." Ran his arm through this fellow's arm, led him down to a restaurant, and that's where the story ends. They went in, and I suppose he blew his whole quarter on one meal for this fellow. But gee, that'd be the best thing he could do, you know, to go hungry for a while and really feel the nip of the thing. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that a few days of that kind of thing doesn't do it. It isn't real. It's like going in a movie, you know, it's real at the time, and then 3 or 4 months later you can't even remember what the story was about, and so on. And then, too, they knew they could escape it at any time. So you have to do more. So we sent them all down to Selma, Alabama, and Martin Luther King put up $600 to give them a special course of training, an 80-hour course, so they learned to register Negroes to vote and to teach them the things they had to about the Constitution and so on, to vote. Well, at the end of the week, I'm sorry to tell you that Septima Clark, the wonderful instructor in charge, phoned me and said, "Morris, why did you send these pampered boys and girls down here? They don't know anything about race prejudice. They never have been the brunt of real prejudice. They're a nice group, but they have to be picked up after a good deal. And they go out and do a little registering, maybe 3 or 4 hours, and then they come in and stay around the swimming pool at the Negro Motel and splash around and have a good time." Well, I didn't know quite what to do further to get them into this problem method, you know. And then James Meredith was shot. And that touched the students. So the students and the faculty all drove from Selma, Alabama, over to wherever this march was in Mississippi. Well, of course, when you're called the director of a school like this, it doesn't have any director. When I go around the world setting up centers and come back, it's embarrassing how much better it's going, you know, than it was when I left. But it has really a philosophy and a direction. And they don't need me one bit, but I beg you to keep that a secret from the trustees. Well, I began getting phone calls What about my darling daughter down there, my son? So, is there a senior faculty member with them? I said, yes, there'll be a senior. So I flew down. I was 71 the day I marched 18 miles on Canton. Hot asphalt roads, not enough water, not enough food, and so on. Well, I began seeing what was happening to the students. There was a little girl, I won't call her name, but she had leaned on a psychiatrist for many years, though she was young, and had a big floppy hat to attract attention, and you thought she was Daniel Boone with little squirrel tails and feathers and everything woven in to attract attention. Well, all those doodads fell out, and then she lost her hat. And she was made a nurse's aide, and she went up and down binding feet, white and black, you know, and giving out aspirin and everything. All her troubles completely forgotten. And then we came to Canton, and I'll never forget those great, brutish-looking men with their guns resting on the iron picket around the courthouse as we all marched up to the courthouse. Martin Luther King said we were going to put up a tent, and the officers of that county said we weren't at Canton. And he said we're going to put it up in our school, the Negro school. And they said, you aren't. He had sent one little group down with a little tent and had arrested them and confiscated the tent. So they knew that we were in for trouble. And of course, Martin Luther King's had a world of experience, this kind of thing. So when about 2,500 of us assembled on the school grounds, things were pretty tense. But the strategy worked so quickly, see, many police cars pulled up on the windward side. There was a very slow breeze, about 5 miles an hour. They pulled up on the windward side, and Martin Luther King knew what was coming. They got their riot guns all ready, put on gas masks and so on. So he practiced the whole group in getting down and getting up. And then he said, all right, put up the tents. So people began to put up the tents. And when men were under the tent, I happened to be holding one of the poles, I remember, they began firing. Near me, a baby was struck in the stomach with one of these canisters, but for the most part they ripped along the ground, and the gas was, of course, nobody can stand up against that. And so people began running and crying and vomiting and everything. And naturally, instinctively, they ran away from the police, which was exactly what was wanted, which kept them in the gas. But having had some experience with it, I circled quickly out of the gas and headed back towards the police. So there I saw the real deviltry of the thing. They were going under the tent and pulling out men completely unconscious from the gas. And then two of them would systematically work them over. Each with his butt of his rifle would knock off the hat, grazing the head. Then one would take the ribs and one would take the head and slash with the butt of the gun on the side, and then on the other side, and then his head. Cracking his head, cracking ribs, and so on. Well, as I saw two of these human beings get up, as a Quaker, I have to believe that there is that of beauty, divinity, whatever you want. And so I said to two of them, I don't see, my friends, how in the world you can treat an unconscious person that way. And you know, for a few seconds, they became human and looked at me as a human being. And they were people who were churchgoers, you know, and regarded themselves as Christian. Everybody down there is either Baptist or Methodist, unless somebody's been tinkering with their religion, you know. So on Sundays, they were fine, I guess. And then instantly, they were brought back to their, quote, duty. And one of them said to me, you get back or we'll put this gun into your belly. And so on. Then we formed and marched around and so on. The next morning, I called the students together and said, we're students. We're not an army. We're out for experience as a basis of motivation to study. Now, I ask that you all not continue further on this march. They're going to try to put up a tent. Things are apt to be worse. Get your 4 years of experience and become people skilled in helping to make the world better. But we've had enough of this for now, in my judgment. Well, they said, Morris, you're trying to make quitters out of us. I said, I'm trying to make students out of you. Now it's time to really study some of these things. Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma and things of that kind. Statistics and all of it. But they protested. And so, really partly to try them, I said, then I'm closing the school and I'm impounding the buses and I'm impounding all money. Now, what about it? They said, we weren't using the buses, we were walking. Wasn't it about it to spend money? They give us what little food they is. And as to the school, we say, this is it. They went on to Jackson. Now, that's a long story, but I don't think you can quickly understand the meaning of moving over to a pragmatic method from a more formal method. If I've exaggerated, I'm sorry. I'm trying to make a point clear, but I could take other illustrations in other fields of it. You will remember that Dewey's analysis of the thinking process, and I regard it as his greatest contribution to mankind, holds that there's an ongoing activity, that one meets with an obstacle, that at that moment of meeting an obstacle, one gives way either to anger that can easily turn to violence, or that one turns to reason and uses his imagination to think of as many creative solutions as he can. Then he exercises his judgment in choosing the most hopeful of those. Then he exercises his willpower, persistence, in pursuing that to a purpose. Then, having attained his purpose, he looks back over the experience and, as Dewey said, reconstructs his experience and then turns and selects another purpose and moves towards that purpose. So education becomes a process of continual reconstruction of experience. That leads then, if you will broaden in your own mind on that problem-solving method, to all of the great problems that mankind faces: conservation, population explosion, poverty, war, race prejudice, crime, juvenile delinquency, and many times that many. Comes then to the part that I find the students have the most difficulty in understanding. This part of it, this common not only with FWI, but with many of the other ventures, holds that we are in a crisis period in human history, and that as a Chinese symbol for crisis suggests both opportunity and danger, so the time that we are living in suggests both opportunity and danger. That it's really like the period of metamorphosis in biology. I hope there's no biologist here, because I'm not, but the best I understand is that a tobacco worm, and because I dislike tobacco so much, I choose a poor tobacco worm to illustrate, creeps slowly on its belly, munching on tobacco leaves, until inside processes take place in sequence that lead to maturation, to the point that certain glands begin to excrete long filaments, silken filaments. Then an instinct overtakes him to twist and turn until he winds himself into a cocoon. And at that point, he appears to die. His green skin turns brown. The organs of the inside disintegrate, and he becomes a sort of gelatinous goo. And if you could see through the cocoon with a microscope, you would tend to say this thing's moribund, dead, no hope for it. But in the marvelous process of metamorphosis, there are microscopic principles around which that same old material takes shape. And now not a worm is created out of this gelatinous goo, but a creature with antennae and with wings and legs. And one day he nibbles a hole in the top, comes out, his moist wings dry, spread, and are iridescent. And this creature, which before had crawled, as I said, slowly on its belly, munching its way along, now takes wing and flies. I believe with all my heart that mankind is in just such a state of metamorphosis, that the war in Vietnam and the problem in Korea and the problems in so many, many parts of the world today, and right here in our own country, in rural slums and urban slums, are the agonies of the dying of the old, and that the new is ready to be born. And that one function of world education is to identify those principles about which civilization can reshape itself so that mankind can be lifted to a plateau infinitely beyond anything we've known in the past 500,000 years. Now, it's anybody's guess as to what those are. Our school, for one, spends its major effort in trying to find what those are. I think we are far enough along in that process of metamorphosis so that certain of those changes are very obvious indeed. I think it's not dogmatic to say that they are here and are part of the new world. When I was a child, the world was divided into political units only. And they were not joined in any way together as a world organization. I tell you that when I was 12 and sat next to my father, for days I wanted to ask him a question but was too shy. And finally I did get up my courage and said, "Father, it seems to me that 100 years ago, every American carried his own gun. Courts didn't amount to much, a police force. But then we decided to get rid of most of those guns and have the police and the court, and things are very much better. But it seems to me that every nation carries its own weapons, and that we have no world court and no world government." Well, my father looked at me as though he had never laid eyes on me before, and he said, "Morris, I didn't know you thought about things like that."